The 8th Annual Men's Gathering is happening at Lakeview Villages in Seymour, Indiana, the weekend after Easter, April 21st through the 24th. Join other Christian men for a relaxing weekend of fellowship, feasting, and fun of every kind. Men will learn how to resist tyranny and how to have a good conscience as fathers, men of the church, and citizens from our main speaker, Dr. Kuntz. He'll guide everyone there through scripture and church history as we seek to live as free men.
Check out our website at www.mensgathering.us for more information and to register. You can also search Men's Gathering on Facebook for updates leading up to the event. It is going to be a wonderful weekend for men to relax in God's beautiful creation. The timely topic will be an encouragement and provide much-needed strength as we go to battle against the powers of this world.
We hope you'll join us for the 2022 Men's Gathering, a proud supporter of A Brief History of Power.
North Idaho is home to beautiful mountains and scenic lakes, small-town tranquility, civil freedom, and the faithful Lutheran parish of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, located in Hayden, Idaho, near Coeur d'Alene. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church is a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. If you like what you hear on Brief History, then you will love Blessed Sacrament, where the Lord's Word is faithfully preached and Christ's body and blood are administered at every divine service. Whether you are visiting Idaho or considering moving to Idaho, wouldn't it be nice? Please join the saints of Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church for the Mass and Augsburg Academy Bible Study. Directions, service times, and much more information about this confessional liturgical parish may be found at blessedsacramentlutheranchurch.com. Blessed Sacrament Lutheran Church, Historic Christian Orthodoxy, the Evangelical Lutheran Faith, in the beautiful inland Northwest. At 7,123 feet, you can find mountains soaring above you and rivers running swiftly in the valley below you, natural beauty of every kind. But our God is richer in his gifts than this. At 7,123 feet in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, you can also find God's Word preached purely and His sacraments given out for your salvation at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School. Located off US 160 just west of downtown Pagosa, Our Savior offers your children a wonderful place to learn of Christ and His wisdom week in and week out, and offers you the medicine of immortality Sunday in and Sunday out. Our Savior Lutheran School provides a Christ-focused classical education that enriches the child's soul with the best that has been thought and said to the glory of God. Whether you visit while vacationing or hunting in the beauty of the area, or whether you would like to join a group of faithful Lutheran Christians, Our Savior Pagosa Springs has what you're looking for. Divine service with Holy Communion is each Sunday at 9 a.m., and Bible class follows at 10:30. At more than a mile high, you will find Christ in all His glory in the midst of His people at Our Savior Lutheran Church and School, a proud sponsor of A Brief History of Power. Find out more at oslcpagosa.org.
Dr. Kuntz, last time we talked about Quigley's framework for understanding the rise and fall of civilizations through four different factors or time periods that you conflict, expansion, apex, and decline. And something we didn't talk about, but was there in the notes, was that it's helpful to see these as a series of layers as opposed to just periods. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, because this has to do with something we've talked about in a variety of other ways on the show, which is that people think of certain things as just in the past, just firmly there, and we're never going back there. So at some time in the past, you know, men and women had certain relationships to each other, which were what we would now call traditional, not a word they used, but traditional. And those were their relationships. You know, your grandma always, you know, made dinner at this time for your grandpa, but you don't do it that way because that was in the past. And when people think about their own culture, nation, civilization at a larger level, as well as their family history, they often think of things as just in the past. So in the past, people raised the food that they ate, but we don't do that, right? So this is the source of a lot of, you know, tourism in Northern Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, surrounding the Amish, that people go and see the Amish. And I think they see them as, you know, in the past, right? Because they use horses and they live on these farms and they have all these kids and stuff like that. That idea is understandable, but wrong, I think, in this way, because the stages of change that civilizations go through, the different kinds of revolutions that we talked about last week, agricultural, industrial, demographic, are from a certain standpoint, just layers sitting on top of each other right now. So this has to do with understanding like what could go away or what could be added wherever you are listening to this, because this involves like, okay, well, how do we get clean drinking water into our city and take dirty water out of our city? Or how do we get food into our city of these different kinds? And then how do we get it out of our city? So one way that I look at this is prior to railroads or any really extensive shipping of any kind, what did people in your area eat? Prior to railroads, did your area exist as an area that was settled in any way? And if it wasn't, what did people eat there? Because that will probably tell you, in addition to how did they build houses or what did they do at different times of the day or times of the year, that will probably tell you more about what is best attuned to your geography or human or other biology in that area than, you know, imagining, okay, well, you know, I live in Phoenix, but I want to play ice hockey. That's like, that's cool. And if that doesn't go away, good for you, play ice hockey. But that, that kind of is a little fragile, right? So starting to think about fragility in terms of human groups or settlements and stuff, fragility is a measure of like, which layer are we on? Because probably the bottom layer that just makes human settlement possible wherever you are is fairly robust. I mean, maybe it's not, maybe you live like inside the Arctic Circle somewhere and it's either doing whatever you're doing right now or like, you know, hunting polar bears. But generally that bottom layer that just makes the existence of life in your area possible is probably pretty robust, but there might be a lot of stuff on top of that that isn't that robust. So you have to start thinking about things that you think of as from the past as more like base layers for the present rather than, oh, well, that was just back then and that's people did that and that doesn't matter anymore.
So in terms of like water systems in cities, you know, those are base layers that remain, but they also seem to have their own fragility involved. And, you know, Phoenix is one thing. I mean, you're pumping water from far away, but, right, you know, cities often arise around rivers because it's a water source, right? And then the modern city has found a way to pipe that stuff in various places. And it seems to be one of the most important things that you have going on in your locality, wherever that is. They also seem to be some of the most neglected places that I've driven by. I mean, depending on where you are, but, you know.
Yeah.
And so is that what you're talking about? Or do you have something else in mind in terms of what we should be looking for as underlying stability? I mean, a church that has people who believe some of the same things about duty and the future, like, I would see that as an underlying layer of stability.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, because there are geographic factors, biological factors, engineering factors. There are also human factors. So your city has this or that density, but that was built on, you know, whatever. Everyone spoke the same language, for example. And now, you know, daily interactions are drastically different because you're all wearing masks and you speak 10 different languages anyway. So human communication is a lot harder now, if not impossible, because of that. So yeah, those kinds of factors are huge. And we haven't even gotten into those so much. I've been talking about geographic stuff, but what Quigley would call something more like ideology, but also not in his terms, but culture and language and manners and lots of things like that, where those have changed drastically you know, I gave the example, I think a couple of weeks ago of, okay, I'm going to get a lot of other, you know, white men that were born in central Pennsylvania and we're going to move to Ghana. It's not Ghana anymore. It's not Ghana anymore. So those human factors also are going to change the nature of human settlement there. What is possible? What is normal? Yeah, all of that is hugely important. And those are, I think those human factors can change more rapidly because people are more changeable, obviously, than the courses of rivers or, you know, where a mountain is located or something, obviously. But those human factors are more, let's say, volatile, but it's not like they matter less because there are certain, you know, political movements, for example, they're going to be really invested in beautifying a city. That was a really big movement in American cities like 120 years ago. Does that exist at all? I mean, is anyone pushing to make New York vastly more beautiful than it is right now? Maybe. I'm sure there's somebody. New York is huge, right? But a lot of what we know out of New York, certainly the hot political topics have to do with people just being sort of randomly shot without police intervention.
Yeah, or putting their brothers in daylight. Putting their brother into new positions of authority with big salaries, yeah. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So we're not in a position right now in New York City to say, hey, they did Central Park in the 19th century. Let's do something just as big and amazing and beautiful and wonderful for everyone to use in the 21st. They're not there right now politically.
No, you just funnel money through the modern art stuff into, yeah. You know, ugly stuff right. that yep. obscures reality. I don't know if this connects directly or not, but I thought this after something you said recently, and I'd asked you a couple weeks ago about, you know, what is Lutheranism and what mm-hmm. is the Lutheran Church. And mm-hmm. trying to kind of put us somewhere on a map in my own worldview. And I'm still struggling with that. The phrase or the thought here is that Lutherans are not a people. And we kind of ought to be. And this gets to what we were just asking about then. You know, so the humanity that you can trust has something that's shared. And if you are in your average Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation, or maybe the Wells or the ELS will reflect some of these things as well. So I think they're more of a people, actually, in those bodies.
Yeah, agreed. Well, they both have ethnic identities, which the Missouri Synod really doesn't.
Can you be a people without an ethnic identity?
Historically, no. Like, it would be great to try. But historically, the reason no is partly because of a factor that I think we look at as normal, but it's just not, which is everyone moving around everywhere.
Right.
You know, so right. The reason that people groups tend to be very distinctive in how they look, so genetics, but also linguistics, how they sound, what they wear, you know, you can, you can get, they might all look the same to you, but they're not, you know, different valleys in Norway have different traditional costumes. The reason for that is because no one goes anywhere. So if people are going everywhere, then that is going to affect their capacity to think of themselves as a unified people. And I mean, we're, you know, maybe complaining about this with the LCMS, but as a denomination, whatever that is, we're a lot better as to identity than many. Part of the reason that the Wisconsin Synod and the ELS are different to the degree that they are, is because the Wisconsin Synod was, until the 1970s, way more rural than we are, or ever were. I mean, this is just a misconception about the Missouri Synod's past. We have always been a, not necessarily majority, but certainly in terms of pastors and congregations that are really important, mm-hmm. we are an urban Midwestern denomination. That is what has always mattered. And still does. I mean, that's where both our seminaries are. So we are an urban Midwestern denomination, and we have been urban, and our people have moved around, and we sent people there. So let's say it this way. If you are very successful in carrying out the mission of Christ, which certainly at a certain time in our nation's history, the LCMS was successful. They were very, you know, dynamic in founding new congregations. I mean, you know, Winnicken, who did all this work in Ohio and Indiana, died in San Francisco.
Started in Maryland,
right. And that's because we're a post-railroad denomination. You know, we didn't rely on horseback to get all of this done. So that's fine, right? But the thing there is that then by sort of normal historical right, and in a way that I'm very fond of thinking of America, America is not a single nation. And so the idea that you would maintain a unitary, nationalized way of being is practically absurd. And to the degree that it ever existed in our church, it existed because of the centralization of how we made pastors, okay, who also generally came from pastors' homes. So you have a self-perpetuating culture that governs the church, right? Wherever it is, Oregon, Florida, New York, Indiana, the people that are actually kind of running the church, which in the Missouri Synod has always been the clergy, just all these positions practically require you to be a clergyman. So whatever congregational polity is.
Yes, you're not talking about congregations, you're talking about the broader,
the broader church. And then that culture is taken down into those congregations by those men. It doesn't mean that all the people there adopt that. And their ethnic identity is actually, certainly early in the Missouri Synod, going to be various because they're not from the same parts of the German-speaking world. So they don't think of themselves as the same thing. And pastors complain when, you know, they're Saxons and they get put with Volga Germans who in their minds barely speak German and are extremely emotional and angry and sentimental and pietistic. And the Saxons don't like it. So those ethnic differences matter. The Missouri Synod comes way too late in American history to form a combination, you know, new ethnicity, let's say, German Americans with a religious identity. Okay. Pennsylvania Germans who come earlier and are much less mobile form a much more compact identity and then also have a political identity just in their small part of the world. The Missouri Synod's too big and too late to do that and is actually doing its job. It is evangelizing. What you would have to do rather than say, okay, we're going to have a big national thing and it's all going to work and everyone's going to do the same thing, you're going to have to accept, you know, you don't have to say this is going to be like theological, but you have to accept, for instance, let me give you an example of like ethnic difference. Okay. And this is very early. This is the 1870s. When the Missouri Synod discovers what's going to come to be first the English Synod and then the English district of the Missouri Synod, they are people who have moved from Appalachia into southern Missouri, southeastern Missouri. And they are, I mean, they're Americans. They're not, they have German last names, but they're not German in any cultural or linguistic sense that anyone would recognize. And they have certain differences from the Germans, obviously language, which affects a lot about how you think about the world and who you talk to and the thoughts that you have, but also even just the way that they do church. So their sermons are really long, which you would expect being Southerners, that their ambient culture is not, you know, 10-minute sermons by a Catholic priest, as it might be if you were from Eastern Prussia and you were Lutheran and most other people are going to be Catholic. The people around these folks are, you know, Baptists and Methodists and stuff, and they preach for a long time. So these folks preach for a long time. Okay. And they don't wear many vestments and their churches are very plain. They're generally very poor people. I mean, it's kind of, you know, the Ozarks are to some extent kind of Appalachia outside of Appalachia, just in settlement patterns. So you would have to just accept that those people are just going to kind of live differently and be differently, maybe run their churches differently than you do because you're urbanized and extremely well-educated and play the violin and the organ, and you don't really speak English. And that would have to be accepted both ethnically for the different ethnicities, which the Missouri Synod always has some. We had some Finns, we had some Slovaks, some Poles, some Italians, actually, in New Jersey, but not that many. And you'd have to accept that it would be regionally various. And that would just change everything about the way that we've run things. So, but I mean, I could see that you could forge a people around a religion on the American continent if you had enough time. It's happened before.
Well, yeah.
You just need to give up the idea that it's going to be from Oregon to Florida to New York, you know, to Arizona, and it's all going to be totally the same.
The same, right. What I've been thinking about as you're talking here is how Rome has managed to be more of a civilization than a people. They have many peoples. They do have distinctions. I mean, globally, you can talk about how divided they are, in fact. And yet, They're very homogeneous in terms of their commitment to being Roman, as opposed to the Lutheran sort of more of a commitment to being post-German kind of thing. And the other point I want to throw in here is just I don't intend to be complaining, if that's what people hear, if that's what you hear us doing, listener. What I really want to do is to diagnose where we are, regardless of whether it is happy or unhappy, and trying to be a people through the philosophical education of a narrow set of ideas that you must be highly educated to understand and or debate hasn't been a winning game for us.
Yeah.
This isn't to say theology doesn't matter, but maybe scholasticism doesn't matter quite the way that we want to think it does. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that on the question of Rome, I think that what they are organized very capably for, and I take this not like to our shame necessarily, but certainly as a lesson for other people, is that they are well organized to keep things organizationally coherent with allowance for many kinds of variety, including kinds of theological variety that we really could not permit. But I mean, the difference between how Irish parishes operate versus German versus Polish, and which ethnicity gets to be bishop in which diocese based on prevalent, you know, ethnicities of the various parishes, and letting the parishes be ethnically and thus culturally very distinctive from one another. And they're still relatively good at that, okay? Because they're, I think, accepting both, you know, the very broad basis of Catholic immigration to America, but also they're accepting the fact that ethnicity is not necessarily bad or something to be ashamed of, nor is it something necessarily to center the church body on, right? The church body does not, you know, nationally or whatever, regionally, doesn't have to be centered on being German or being Appalachian or being Greek or being Armenian. That's a problem that the Eastern Orthodox are constantly dealing with. And now they have all these really Anglo-Saxon Americans becoming Eastern Orthodox, especially in the South. And, you know, what do you do with those people? Because the music is not actually their music. It's from Russia or, you know, Syria or something. And none of it is theirs culturally, but they're adopting it. And the way that they adopt it is very interesting to watch for that reason. So you have to let people, I mean, if you're a Christian, you do have to let people continue existing in the cultures, not necessarily the civilization, but the cultures that they are a part of.
Right.
That will be transformed by the gospel, but it will be there.
Right.
People will eat different food in Alabama from Ohio, and that's actually a good thing.
So that becomes a problem for us diagnostically when you get into the idea of worship and what worship looks like. It also is, again, the article upon which the church stands or falls, a very narrow philosophical understanding of justification and a hyper-emphasis on it being the only thing we talk about when it comes to our distinctiveness, I think has prevented what was a people from absorbing other people. It's have to become like us to be one of us, and that doesn't mean Jesus is risen. It means you're gonna thump your Book of Concord, and I'm a guy who does that. So please, I think the Book of Concord is very, very important, but I'm concerned here again about what it looks like to be church together when you run into a parish that, because some guy adopted Finneyism 50 years ago, now doesn't look Lutheran, but they want to be Lutheran.
Sure.
What do you do?
Well, I think that the reason that people get distressed by that, and certainly I talk to pastors and people who want to be pastors all the time, they get distressed by stuff like that. The only reason to be distressed by the fact that people are not where you need them to be is because I think you're overthinking the cognizance of and the relative impact of your preaching and people's grasp of it.
Amen.
In the present generation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you're going to build a long-lasting thing of any kind with a group of people, you need to let time be given for that to happen. So think about how much time it's going to take to get people from reflexively praying to the Virgin Mary in some very Lutheran place like Franconia or Saxony to a time when that becomes unthinkable. That doesn't mean that your preaching is going to be doctrinally different in the time when you begin saying you shouldn't do that to a time when preaching an entire sermon about why you shouldn't pray to the Virgin Mary becomes needless. Okay. You know, your doctrine hasn't changed. The guy earlier believes the same stuff in the Book of Concord as the guy later. Okay. The difference is that you are attentive to what is needful and you do and say what is needful, not what would be necessarily like the most on-point sermon from 200 years ago, nor do you have to get angry that people's lives are not completely attuned to what you think should happen. I mean, and some of that is just sheer arrogance. I mean, to return to the example that I used earlier, Walther, C.F.W. Walther, was extremely suspicious of these people in, you know, Ozark area, Missouri, because they didn't, they weren't, for lack of a better word, as high church as the Saxons, because nobody in America was. Mm-hmm. And that kind of suspicion and just assumption that everything that you're familiar with is normal and obvious is natural is as foolhardy in the church as it is, as we talked about last week, in thinking economically about a generation that has a completely different set of economic conditions from your own. You don't have to be angry at people for existing differently from you. But if you're going to deal with them, you have to figure out what needs to be jettisoned for their welfare, for their salvation, whatever your criterion is, just economically, maybe for their capacity to get a job, whatever that might be, right? If you want to do good to them, you have to understand how they live and why they live that way, and then change from there. You can't just be so impatient with people for not affirming things that are very abstract to your average human being and are incomprehensible, right? And let me give an example of this, and then I'll, you know, stop for a second. Is, you know, I was never musically educated, right? Everything that I know how to chant or sing in the liturgy or the hymnal or whatever, I basically learned from like ear memory. Okay. I don't know anything. I don't understand what's going on or why it's happening. People will argue incessantly about things that make no sense to me. And do you know what I do when that happens musically or with regard to, I just write it off because it doesn't make any sense. So then imagine that you're bringing completely new ideas into somebody's life. You're trying to bring, you know, whatever, Christianity to Japan. And you are, you know, so angry that they're not accepting this and they're hostile. What else are they going to do? What do you think is historically plausible or normal? It would be confusion and rejection. You know, don't be surprised by any of that. Likewise, if you're trying to build something lasting, don't be surprised if it takes a long time. You know, life's not a video game.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think to bring it back to my narrow point I was hitting on earlier, saying that Jesus is risen from the dead and reigns to all eternity is to proclaim the justification of the sinner, unless you deny that. But mm-hmm. in and of itself, that's what the Holy Spirit says that means. And so this idea that, you know, what is needful right now may not be the dogmatic construction that was needful for a debate against, you know, early 20th century modernism, as Pieper formulates it. What he says is true, right? But how we say it now, or another way to look at it is, you know, can we recover? This is my own thing. Can we recover biblical talk? Can we recover being a people of the Bible? Because the difference between us and Rome, it seems to be, is they have a submission to a shared source they will not bend down on. And what we find, at least in the kind of the culture of the Missouri Synod, is there is no shared source of submission. And Sola Scriptura once was that. The battle for the Bible, in theory, kept that. But I think, you know, many people will be quick to recognize it didn't. It didn't at all. Transitioning to Japan, I mean, yeah, it becomes what the Japanese experience when initially they have the Jesuits. And the Jesuits are like, well, this is Christianity. And then suddenly there's these, you know, Dutch and English that show up and are talking about how there's this Protestant idea, right? And it becomes a matter of detail to the Japanese, which in part leads to their refusal to modernize, right? Which is really what we're supposed to talk about today.
Right.
Right.
And I don't think it's a distraction. And I mean, I know we have Catholic listeners. So, I mean, I'll say this, like, all of this requires work. So if you're Catholic right now and you're not trying to figure out how to get a canonical dispensation, you know, what on its face appears to be a banning of the traditional Latin Mass, then you're never going to get the traditional Latin Mass. It's going to go away and it's not coming back. Similarly, if you're basic, you know, and then you also need to think about what is going on with the Pope and how are you supposed to relate to the Pope? If you're Lutheran and you're actually working with the Bible collectively, then it really doesn't matter what else you do or say. It's not going to hold together. The whole thing is built on the idea of imminent, you know, authority of the Holy Spirit accessible through the words of Scripture. If those aren't used, studied, debated, and then finally codified in some kind of usable way, whether you call it a dogma or a confession or whatever it is that you need, then you're not going to exist. That's just, I mean, you can't have civilization without work. And I think when people think about it, they think of it as just, well, we're going to hold on to it, or we're going to save it, or whatever. And that sounds like, well, if I just know enough, you know, like if I read some great books, you know, in English probably. And then, you know, I know, you know, some references in Tolkien, like I'm saving Western civilization. It's a lot harder than that. I'm sorry to tell you. So when you think about, okay, well, how do the Japanese remain as distinctive as they did? You don't, obviously, if you're a Christian, you don't agree with the idea that they rejected both Roman Catholic and also in the Dutch Reformed Christianity. Well, the way that they do that, even before they're forced to open, is they decide that this is an existential threat, like they know history, like existential threats they faced in the past from completely different peoples who were not trying to give them Christianity, right? But with the Japanese, because they're an island, that's your base layer, because they're an island, they experience everyone else as a foreign intrusion. It doesn't matter that what precisely the ideological difference would be between the Mongols, you know, in the 15th century and the Portuguese and the Dutch and the English. It doesn't matter, really. It's all a foreign intrusion. And Japan, because of its geographic isolation, is able to maintain even certain ideological changes to the civilizations that have impacted the most, especially the Chinese, where like Japan is one of maybe the only place in the world, one of the few places certainly, where you can get a funeral done by a Buddhist priest. And that's because of the specific way in which Buddhism has occupied all the nooks and crannies of Japanese religion that Shinto will not touch. So because a Shinto priest is just not allowed to go near the dead, you have a religious, let's say, provider that can do that if they want to, could come up with some philosophical justification. So uniquely in Japan, if I am remembering correctly, uniquely Buddhist priests provide funeral services in Japan. So that's an example where if you're isolated enough, you can amalgamate foreign things, ideas like Buddhism, in your own particular way, in a way that is not completely destructive of whatever ongoing cultural or civilizational achievements you do have.
Their refusal to modernize, though, again, to get back to the existential threat, they saw the West as a threat very clearly. And since we've been advocating that the West is Christendom and can't be distinct from that, and because what we're going to talk about, you know, the power of Shinto as a religion, I think those things tie together. The Jesuit initial move into the space, and God bless the Jesuits for their mission, but they weren't always about the mission. It didn't exactly convince them that there had been a revelation from on high that changed everything. Rather, you saw, I believe, and Rome's been done this in many places, a little more of a fusion, an allowance for certain ideas to be held in a veneer of Rome to be put over it. In the belief, though, I mean, what we're advocating, that over time, that will bleed out, right? That over time, them wearing the crucifix will change who they are generationally. But again, they saw that as a threat. And I think, in a sense, very wisely, if I'm thinking in a worldly way, if you want to survive as a people and there is something that is an existential threat, you got to reject it. And then to bring it back to the worship stuff, that is my position against so-called praise and worship. It's never been about guitar or organ. It's always about the existential threat it brings to the sacrament. And so, yeah, I take it from there, however you want to take it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're right to say that they're very wise according to the world, because it permits them not to be eviscerated by an ideological change that, in the case of the West, usually happened either in the, you know, relatively already diffuse urban environments around the Mediterranean Sea early on in Christianity. And then after that, largely as a folk phenomenon, right? So your group becomes Christian, often with the leadership of whatever your overlord is, right? Whether you are still a tribal entity in Northern Europe or some kind of constituted polity, Christianization has plenty of conflict, but does not, you know, is not appealing to the same kind of, you know, atomized individuals that we would if we had a church in, you know, Pensacola today,
right?
Where, you know, what do people in Pensacola have in common? Well, they live in Pensacola. That's probably about it. You know, maybe they have some connection to the Navy, but, you know, it's not.
They don't have a Daimo who makes every decision. And then when all that decision is made, you do it, yeah, no matter what, and you kill yourself if,
right,
you shame yourself. It nothing like that.
Right. 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 And so the idea that this would in any way, you know, the accusation that Christians are turning the world upside down, that from this, you know, let's say worldly wisdom perspective, makes a lot of sense as an accusation, because it's calling for individual thoughts about the nature of reality. And that has to be recognized for the historical oddity that it is. And it's not even as if most of our ancestors who were Christian, assuming that they were, it's not as if they sat around thinking, you know, about what might be, and do they want to sit there and be Buddhist? I mean, I mean, give you an example from my own life. Growing up in Appalachia, it's not like I ever sat there and thought, do I want to be Buddhist? You know, like the religion I didn't believe in was Protestant Christianity. So it's not really that surprising. And obviously I thank God for this, that I became a Protestant Christian when I became a Christian. Because I wasn't sitting there thinking, maybe I will participate in Shinto, you know, or, you know, maybe I want to be a Peruvian Roman Catholic, which means some cross between, you know, traditional Quechua religion and whatever, you know, remnants of Roman Catholicism I'm choosing to engage in. I always wasn't attending a Protestant Christian church, because that's what's available where I'm from. So, you know, those realities of what kind of provision are you making, and how is that integrating with a people's way of life, has to be asked whether you're seeking to start a new church or to preserve something today, or to preserve something for the sake of eventually starting something new. Is how is this going to fit into who the people are and the way that they live and the history that they have? Because Christianity doesn't come in and just efface all of that. We don't bring, you know, a special holy language that you would memorize for a holy book, even if you don't understand it, like the Indonesians who can recite the whole Quran, even though they don't understand Arabic. We translate, you know, the Holy Spirit translates. So you have to ask yourself, like, okay, well, what would it be like if Japanese people who were fully Japanese and never had to go anywhere else to learn another language, what would it be like for them to be Christians?
So they're closing of themselves off to the Christian West because of a variety of issues. It was more complex than just Protestant versus Catholic, but that played a role.
Yep.
Leads to them missing the Industrial Revolution. And they just kind of have their island for a while. Now, you know, I mean, they trade with China, I understand. There was one port that was open to China. So, you know, the idea that they were completely closed off has been sort of a poo-poo of recent modern history. But they were isolated. Big isolation.
They were isolated because their exposure to others is on their own terms. So the European exception here are the Dutch at Nagasaki. And just on a kind of a horribly sad side note, the two cities that we firebomb in the Second World War are the most Christian places in Japan. and we destroyed them. Okay. We destroyed them. So this is something we'll be discussing, you know, much later in the year when we talk about the nature of the United States as a world power. Just that's one of the things that we have done. We destroyed them. Nagasaki is one of those places. Not coincidentally, it is a place where any kind of average Japanese man would have access to a foreigner during the long time of their isolation, which is roughly 200 years. And the Dutch are not allowed to discuss religion. They're certainly not evangelizing or sending preachers. The kinds of challenges that the Japanese faced off, more seriously from Catholics than Protestants, but to some degree from both, are now confined to their relationship to non-Japanese will be a commercial relationship, purely and simply, and in a very limited way. And so what that means, and this has to do with something that I know folks have talked about on the Discord before, and I don't have a comprehensive explanation on this, but here is part of my thinking about why, despite the enormous efforts, absolutely enormous efforts by Christians to evangelize Japan since its opening to foreign, you know, permanent residents, let's say, since the 1850s, 1860s, why have so few Japanese become Christians despite its level of education and knowledge of non-Japanese cultures and long residence and money poured into it, is that the relationship to non-Japanese has always been conditioned along these various lines with, you know, sometimes explicit, sometimes implicit proviso that this is finally a material relationship that we have to non-Japanese. This is a relationship that will be limited to how we make money, how we make stuff, what kinds of investments we're making in other countries or are being made in Japan. This will not be a relationship that will cause us to change fundamentally. I don't think that played out entirely. I think they have been changed fundamentally, but that has never been the idea, either before the opening in the 1850s or afterward.
Yeah, there's a spirit of preservation there, which again is enviable, honestly.
Right.
It's what allows them to make such incredible contributions to science and art, even without the modernization taking place.
Right.
So when the forest opening happens, I don't know how much you want to get into the history of that, but yeah. I can recommend Dan Carlin's Hardcore History Supernova in the East. He goes through kind of detail by detail that 10-20 year period where the former shogun forces a modernization to take place, an industrialization to take place in a very, very short amount of time. And one of the questions is like, how? Then like, could anyone but the Japanese have done this? Is a little question there as well, because it was part of their commitment to duty following the leader that enabled this to take place. It's just such a unique place.
Yeah, it is. And it is for a set of reasons that I think a lot of people enjoy and understand, but they have to know where this came from. I've talked about the geographic factor of being a series of islands with, you know, Honshu being obviously the biggest and most important always, but that in the Japanese past, in its ancient past, is what would, if it were a white country, be called a genocide of what are sometimes, I mean, some this has begun to crop up in Japan. The Ainu, who are a Siberid people. There was speculation at one time that they were some sort of like lost Europeans because they can grow beards and have different facial structure. But that the Japanese, the Yamato people, right? The Japanese, what we think of as the Japanese people, they destroyed these people, pushed them to the fringes of the Japanese islands, mostly Hokkaido, and they are stuck there, right? So you... in order to have the kind of unity of action and thought necessary requires a homogeneity that I think a lot of times, like people will visit somewhere like Japan or Finland or Iceland, you know, Iceland, another ethnically homogeneous island. And they'll say, it's so nice here, or people are so polite or whatever. you know, this requires a degree of homogeneity and similarity for everything to work the way it does and people behave the way they do that we don't have. And if you have a differing understanding of who can live next to whom and who should be with whom, then you just have to accept this is never going to be like Japan, because Japan is a country that has secured its ethnic homogeneity. I mean, that's why the Japanese have, you know, different words for which generation away from the Japanese islands this person who grew up in America or Brazil is, because of their understanding of themselves as a people.
Regardless of their current demographic crisis and seemingly unwillingness to move forward in history, which is its own piece, I suppose.
Right. Which is a way in which I don't think that they have gone through this, like, you know, unaffected by modernity. Right.
Yeah. Right.
I think they have been fundamentally changed. In the beginning, the reason that you can secure that kind of unanimity is because you are not dealing. I mean, Germany is a, you know, biologically and linguistically wildly diverse place compared to Japan. So there's that in the ancient past. In the recent past, what you have is, and this is really important, and I think this was extremely savvy on the part of the men who did open up Japan, is that they treated it as if it were in continuity with the past. I think they understood extremely well their nation's history, their nation's, you know, formal and informal political functioning, what would be plausible to people, understandable. And they said, this is a restoration of the divine emperor.
Right.
Right. This is a restoration. This is the Meiji restoration. And, you know, because it's an island and no one is ever going anywhere, you have a guy from the dynasty that has never been overturned. You know, there's no Wars of the Roses. There's no, you know, rise and fall of the Holy Roman Empire that you have to contend with. We have the guy. And we are restoring him to his rightful place. So I think they were extremely savvy in understanding that for a people for whom history matters, for whom so many things about life are just givens, you want to present change as an accentuation or a brightening up or a bringing forth of those givens that are so wonderful. Here they are. This is a restoration. So that, I mean, that to me is one of the savviest political maneuvers within the last two centuries, is the way that the Japanese handled their own entrance into not spiritual modernity in the sense of saying, we love mass democracy or we love, you know, whatever, but into at least a material version of modernity.
Yeah, it really is something, given the lack of role that the emperor had played for a couple hundred years there, at least, right?
Right. I mean, it's a dead letter, basically. You know, for most of Japanese history, the emperor, I mean, who cares? His, you know, functional political might having evaporated in our Middle Ages. But, you know, here he is again, and he really matters. And they manage that very, very well, because they deal with protests, you know, a couple years before, fairly large protests from people who have been pushed into cities by the way that they changed agricultural both operation and also law. And you have all these, and they go through a lot of the same processes that the English do, but they do it in like 40 years. And they get these kind of alienated urban workers, and there's big protests in 1913. And what they do at that point is they take the emperor from being kind of a public figurehead to being a less visible figurehead. But he still remains the figurehead. But they can even sort of manage the puppet, like, you know, do you want him to come all the way out to the front of the stage, or should he stand in the middle of the stage, or, you know, be almost behind the curtain, but we still know he's there. They're very savvy at that, while keeping the same understanding that for a lot of people, life is symbolic. So the symbol has to stay there. You know, the divine emperor is still there. He just doesn't matter as much as he did 10 years ago.
No, and to kind of maybe move us into forward a little bit, what he mattered for was as a religious figure, right? He was part of Shinto more than he was anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And Shinto, you know, if you take into account the stuff that I said about ancient Japan, Shinto is going to be pretty wild, because you're going to read it and be like, oh, this is just the Japanese account of why they are of divine origin and nobody else is. which is just about the most common thing if you study comparative mythology, is that the mythology will be, this is why we as a people are people, which you can hear sometimes even in, the Navajo word for Navajo, the Lenni Lenape word for the Lenni Lenape just means people or the people, because they are fully people and nobody else is. So the Ainu in certain Japanese drawings will look a lot like the monkeys on Hokkaido, because they're not exactly people the way we Yamato are people. So, the emperor is the one who secures that, because he is directly related to the sun goddess Amaterasu, who in Japanese mythology is kind of the founding, mother or founding kami, like spirit being of Japan, which is also the same thing as this people group. And so he authorizes the existence of the people. He authorizes who they are, right? So if you were to get rid of the emperor, or if he were not to be divine, then you would be doing something like saying, okay, Kansas is a monarchy now. I mean, you can try. It just has never, ever been done before. So you have to figure out how to legitimize what you're doing. So it's much easier to say, we're changing like pretty much everything about daily life. And in a while, a lot of you are going to be able to speak English, and you're going to have enormous incomes and live in high rises in Tokyo, which isn't even called Tokyo yet. But hey, the emperor is still the, divine representative of the Japanese people.
So what else does Shinto have in it that makes it so resistant to mission, to conversion?
Shinto, this is something very interesting. And I said last week, I don't really agree with Quigley in a lot of things about Japan. And that's because he sees Shinto as basically just an excuse for something else. So I don't think he believes that devotion to particular groves of trees or a mountain or, Shinto is also very interesting in being largely an iconic. So, you don't know what it is exactly you're worshiping, and there may not even be a particular object inside the shrine, or the shrine, the object or the kami might inhabit a tree or a set of rocks or something. So it's in some ways kind of an abstract religion in a way that is not all that familiar with what you might think of as like pagan or polytheistic or traditional religions. So Quigley basically just sees it as an excuse. It's really funny to watch a Roman Catholic just say, real quick, well, I know that that's your traditional religion, but, that's just an excuse for these people's politics. I mean, that's kind of, Karl Marx, Saturday morning cartoons version, religious analysis. This is just your excuse for, this power grab by this group of people. Shinto, I think, is resistant because it inhabits the landscape in the way that it really is hard to imagine. I mean, I can historically make up whatever scenario and I could write an alternative history book about it, but it's really hard to imagine rural America not populated by churches. I can't really imagine a version of New Hampshire or, Ohio, where the rural areas just have minarets in them. And then, maybe there's a couple of Baptists, but it's mostly minarets. That's not our country as such. Shinto has an even greater density of sites, partly because it is not a paying thing for most of its priests. So it doesn't need to finance itself in the same way that a Christian congregation does necessarily, except for certain shrines, which have often received state assistance and definitely did in the 19th and 20th centuries. Before the Second World War. So it can inhabit the landscape extremely densely. So in the same way that before you even ask yourself, okay, how much do people in Japan actually believe any of this? And in every survey, most Japanese down to today will say that they're not religious, because they identify religion with sort of Western, doctrinal convictions. But they will flood into temples on, New Year's Day and the week around New Year's Day in order to begin the year auspiciously. So you have this really widespread physically visible phenomenon similar to, you know, Lutheran parishes in Norway or Anglican parishes in England. It seems to be everywhere. People may believe not a lot of it, but it's there. And it's a composite, you know, part of them as Japanese people who speak Japanese. And it requires very little commitment, but it's basically everywhere and it's always there. And sometimes the state supports it. But, you know, it's not requiring a lot from you, but it is a component of being who you are genealogically, which is a very powerful claim. So, you know, there you go. That's much more resilient than if you go into a Muslim country and you say, hey, you know about this guy, Jesus? Yeah, he's a prophet. He was born of the Virgin Mary. Hey, you know what? He's the son of God. You're going to get some opposition, but you're at least working within a framework where, you know, what we call religion is a set of dogmatic discussions.
Right.
I mean, and it isn't ethnically specific.
Yeah. So dogmatic, yeah. Philosophical, ideological, independent thought, versus a paganized Buddhism where we're in like a lot of what they do have a dogma. They have a way of life. They have a way in which they think about things, but so much of it is based in nature that it's kind of true. I just say it frankly, you know, I mean, to sit and watch the sunrise is beautiful. Like that's your religion. Okay. But there really is something to that as well in terms of it provides a practical means of life and attuning to that you're not just a material body, that there's more going on.
Yeah. I think also even things that are not going to be specifically stated as dogma may never even rise to the level of verbal affirmation. And this is where some of the stuff that you were saying at the beginning of this episode, I think needs to be understood, not so much by people that write books for a living, but certainly by like pastors and people that, you know, go to church at all, is how much of life cannot be contained in verbal affirmations. So what are all, because thought and feeling are so broad for human beings and largely intuitive and uncontrolled. Okay. Because of that, words expressed, written, spoken, can only ever capture some fraction of that, right? There's only a certain proportion of my thoughts that I can say coherently to you guys. So if you have imbued people's lives with things they don't even have to think about that just seem obvious, certain spirits of blessing inhabit these rocks. Now, because I wasn't raised to think that, and I don't think that is something that I would debate dogmatically and would even be willing to say, if we're a Japanese church, let's have a dogmatic understanding of why that is false, that God is accessible by these means and not that there are multiple gods and they, plural, are accessible through those rocks or that tree or that forest or whatever, right? But, you know, if you can imbue people's sense of themselves with your dogmatic claims without there even being dogmatically stated, then you have achieved a level of stability, especially intergenerational stability, that is really beneficial generally to anybody's religion.
Yeah.
Because an example of something that really probably should have been dogmatically discussed more in our circles is what is confirmation and why are we all doing it? You know, it's not in the Bible. So what are we all doing? Well, it has very powerful roots in most kind of Lutheran home cultures. So, you know, that matters. That's not decisive, but it does matter. Or like I said, you know, for me, like I really can't, I mean, it would just be foreign and weird for me to be something other than a Protestant Christian. That's not a doctrinal conviction. It influences, you know, my being a Protestant Christian. It's not the sole or decisive reason, but it does. I mean, I couldn't be Roman Catholic. They were a completely different group of people growing up. Honestly, totally honestly, just couldn't imagine it, let alone a Buddhist. So those kinds of things that are below, but also therefore much deeper than the level of expression, are extremely powerful. And that, I think, is why Shinto has been so successful, even though its fortunes have waxed and waned over Japanese history. But the reason that it's endured is because it is part of being alive on those islands for the vast majority of people.
Yeah. Your comment about, you know, not being able to be other than what you are because of the past. I guess my one kind of caveat to that would be, barring unexpected and probably extreme religious experience, which not everyone will continue or will consider, you know, monetary policy and the moving into a market for a global economy to be that. But, you know, again, where your ideas won't change, sometimes the pocketbook will compromise you. So how has money changed Japan? And if you want to tell the story too, just kind of move the story forward on that as well.
Yeah, sure. Money has changed Japan in the sense that it has created population densities through processes that are very similar to the ones we talked about with England last week, just sped up drastically. So for instance, they adopt in 1873, this law of primogeniture, meaning the eldest son inherits the farm. And now, because of changes in farming techniques and plumbing, you know, the second and the third sons are alive. So they move to a city. So your relationship to the shrine you grew up with, the people you grew up with, is going to change. That's going to give you new ideas, new impulses, new lots of things. If the population becomes extremely concentrated, as it certainly is by now, with Tokyo being the world's largest metropolitan area, I want to say it's like 37 million people in the metropolitan area, which is, you know, I mean, that's more people than Canada has total. So
wow. Yeah, sure.
That's just an enormous number of people. That is going to affect people's religious practice in the sense of their access to shrines, their sense of what spirits are, just in purely Shinto terms. But then also it's going to affect their sense of, you know, tradition or patriarchy, where Japan is historically what you might call a caste society. And people usually associate that with India, but that extends to the nobility, the samurai, the merchants. They have their own version of the untouchables who handle human waste. All of that is replicated in Japan historically. It's a caste society. So you have a dynamic where you have a caste society like India, but you also have ethnic homogeneity, very unlike India. And all those people are now pushed into cities. So sort of like I think I mentioned last week, tribal identity, caste identity is, you know, greatly weakened, if not dissolved. And new castes are formed. So the police or the nobility, the nature of that all totally changes. And that's all before the First World War. By now, you mentioned earlier Japan's demographic problems. By now, it's not that Japan has, you know, a, you know, incredibly weak sense of itself as a country. I mean, Japan is not Belgium or something, but, you know, their relationship to their own past is much different in 2021 than it was in, say, 1913, even though the changes within individual people's lifetimes were drastically different. And the reason for that is that urbanization correlates eventually with demographic plateaus and then generally of demographic decline. So England is going to plateau before Poland because England industrializes and urbanizes. Those are usually concomitant processes long before Poland. Japan plateaued a while ago. And some of that has to do with the fact that non-Christian cultures practiced abortion and infanticide, that is murder of the preborn and then of the born, before industrialization or demographic change or anything. Okay. So if that was morally acceptable then, it's certainly morally acceptable now because modernity never pushes. I mean, certainly industrialization and financialization of your economy are never going to push fewer women into the workforce. It's always going to be, we want more workers, more consumers. Exceptions may be children, but if we get all the women when they start being adults, that's fine. We can let there not be child workers. That's okay. So you're going to get more abortion the more women you have in the workforce generally, even though in Japan, usually women, even down to today, will only work until they marry and then they will stay at home. But they're not staying at home with four kids, they're staying at home with one kid. And even when the child goes to school, they're going to stay home. So they still have a very different family, let's say, shape from, say, the West, even with the same standard of living. But that has still affected fertility and therefore population in the same way. And this is to kind of bring it around here. The availability of people is one of the bases of expansion. Civilizationally, long before modernity, but certainly in modernity, right? The health of economies, just in purely materialistic terms, let alone everything else, depends on there being more than, you know, 0.9 live births per adult woman in a country, way more generally. So Japan still collapses demographically, and in some ways, partly because of their lack of Christianity, much faster and more intensively than Western countries. And that will eventually come back around, and it will eventually affect everything else. Now, their population is huge relative to what it was 200 years ago, but still, eventually, if you don't have enough people, you're not going to have any of the rest of any of the other stuff either.
Yeah, all the people are going to die because you can't keep the gears turning and you're going to run out of right. food. And this is the 2050 conundrum that we've hit from several different levels. And I say 2050 specifically because, if I recall, it's been a while since I watched the video, but various economists who are not Christian projecting that that's where the apex of the hill of human population will really shift, where we'll see the effects of one-child policies and things like that hit yeah. so that we really begin to go down a slope that we cannot return from, no matter how hard we try. And right. Because I don't know how much you want to follow that or just push into the rest of our bullet points.
I want to follow it briefly to say this, that maybe I've mentioned this before. I simply don't trust government statistics hardly anywhere, but certainly not in like West Africa, where the governments are generally not functioning, let alone counting things in a calm manner. Okay. So that goes
beside
for us
the
now
bribes,
too.
Perhaps. I think they count yeah. the bribes.
Yeah. Who knows what they're doing? But what I think is a misconception people have is that, and this, I see this in Christian circles with a sort of like, you know, valorization of Christians in Africa, Asia, and South America, which is kind of treated in a very colonial 19th century way as sort of all the same, but we never say non-white, we say like global South or something like that, which is kind of a euphemism, I think, for you're all the same in being not us. What are us? We never kind of, you know, answer all of those questions, but that is to say, like, they're Orthodox there, we're not Orthodox here, they're going to send missionaries here, et cetera. And preliminary evidence is that that doesn't work any better than it did in the 19th century when it was going in the other direction. It's very hard to evangelize other people groups. That's why missionaries generally press for native clergy as soon as possible. Also going into that is the sense that they are somehow rising in population. And that is true in the case that, you know, infant mortality has gone down in West Africa in the past 50 years. But the idea that all of that is just somehow sustainable, like that we're going down and they're going up and they're going to keep going up while we go down, underplays the links between us and them,
yeah.
right? Between the United States and West Africa economically. But even biologically, like whom do we feed, or who feeds Japan, or who keeps the lights on in the, you know, power generation stations in Japan or Nigeria or the United States? And until you know the answers to those questions, you really don't know what's going to happen. You can't look at one trend, say, okay, Japan is going down in population and say, oh, Japan's all going down. There are still other options left. So right now, that's why in Japan, you're having a political debate as we record this about immigration, because the Japanese are now having the same debate that we had, not as much in the context of fertility decline, because no one was really talking, they were talking about population bombs in the 60s, but we had a similar debate, and you still hear the same rhetoric, certainly in Europe, not as much in America, which is, our population is going down in France or Germany or whatever. So we need to bring in immigrants. Okay. But you're simultaneously told you shouldn't have kids because it's bad for the planet or whatever. The Japanese are having a version of that debate within a much more ethnically secure, that is, they can say we want to be Japanese, but they still realize that they're declining economically long-term, certainly because they don't have enough children. So it doesn't look the same everywhere because you have to take all these different factors into account, and populations don't magically expand and then magically contract, right? So in the case of the Japanese, you have both modernization, you have changes in how large families are, you also have a history and a practice of abortion that we have not historically had. In Nigeria, you obviously don't have sanctioned abortion, but you have differences in fertility between urbanized Nigerians and rural Nigerians. What are those urbanized Nigerians dependent on? You got to answer all those factors. The reason I say that is simply to say that I think when people think about the present, they're very fatalistic. And they usually latch on to whatever factor they know best. So they've done a lot of research about COVID stuff or demographics or immigration or whatever, okay, infrastructure. And they take that factor and then they run with that factor and they make it somehow like predictive. And the reason not to do that is because you don't know, especially when you have a coherent people group, what will be done with that group ideologically. That ideology should be weighed at least as much as all of these other factors. Don't become like a right-wing Jared Diamond, is what I'm saying. Because if you have someone come along, and this has been tried many times, the example most familiar to me is the novelist Yukio Mishima. I mean, I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but he writes a 4-book series about modern Japan, beginning in kind of pre-World War I era, between their victory over the Russians and their entry into World War I, and going almost down to his present day in the late 1960s. And the reason that he writes this is because he doesn't see these demographic changes, that population growth in his lifetime. Population growth, material expansion, economic betterment, everyone's more comfortable, everyone has more vacation time, everyone lives in a suburb or a city that is of any account. He doesn't see any of that as actually good because he sees it eviscerating the spirit of the Japanese people. They are no longer who they are. They are no longer honorable. They have become, you know, spiritual prostitutes. They'll do or say whatever is required in order to make more money. And for him, this is like the absolute greatest tragedy. But he also understands simultaneously that everyone who has tried to, as it were, go back in modern Japanese history has failed because he's been crushed by the power of the state. So inside the second book, Runaway Horses, is this entire novel called The League of the Divine Wind. I mean, I guess it's like a novella, but it's a history of an actual rebellion that did occur historically, where the samurai who rebelled refused to use Western weapons.
Right, right, yeah.
You know this.
Last Samurai is about that, basically, movie.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I mean, they're so anti-Western, they will refuse to walk underneath, you know, telegraph poles, right? So I guess that's like, you know, refusing to get a smartphone or something, I don't know. But they just hate it. They hate it all. So they go into battle using traditional Japanese weapons, and they, of course, get, you know, slaughtered,
right?
Because they can't compete against firearms. This is in Runaway Horses specifically, which is the one that's set in the context of the Japanese 1930s, which is this time of enormous upheaval inside the various conglomerates, which are political and financial in Japanese politics. And there's an attempted coup and there's an assassination and so on. This failed rebellion is not for young men an occasion to say, okay, well, let's just never try this again. That would be the reaction. And this is where demographic, not just trends, but just what does the population look like in a given place? This is where this really, really, really matters. Is not so much, you know, how many live births per married woman do you have? How many 22-year-old men do you have right now? Because if they are inspired to do something, and enough of them are inspired to do something, even if it failed in the past, it could succeed. Because it is the instinct of, you know, a 42-year-old man, much more than a 22-year-old man, to say,
can't be done.
It didn't work. It didn't work, right? But this is where, you know, knowledge of just human biology and the, you know, amount of testosterone flowing through a 22-year-old that is not flowing through a 42-year-old. If I have enough 22-year-olds, I may actually achieve something. So this novella within this novel is used by the main character, who is a very Japanese thing. Like, the main character in each of the four books is a reincarnation of the original character in the first book. So the reincarnation in this book is an excellent kendo athlete, but also he is inspired not by the failure, but by the idealism. And I think that people get fatalistic partly because they obsess over whatever narrow area that they look at, or they could get too optimistic, but usually they get too depressed. They see their town or their area of expertise, and that's what they know, and that's what they think is determinative. But also because they don't see that change in people comes about partly because of material factors, but also because those material incentives or factors are explained to them in a way which is inspiring and plausible. So if I'm going to form a people or do something more concrete, although still extremely difficult, like stage a rebellion against a powerful government, then I'm going to need to figure out how to inspire people in a way plausible and understandable to them.
Inspiration definitely is at the heart of much of this conversation, I think, not just this week. All right. Well, with our time kind of at its max for this week, do you want to push anything back to next week, or do you want to hit any of the lows we got? What's counterfactual? I mean, that sounds so interesting, that whole phrase, and I don't know that we've hit that yet. So,
And we'll finish up here, and then I'll push the rest of it to next time, when we'll begin to start talking about the rise of finance and of money as such a determinative factor in life, which is not before a certain period, and it's really key to Quigley's framework for understanding the modern world. But Japan is a counterfactual is this idea, which I see especially brought up in right-wing circles, of, you know, a traditional society that has retained its own, you know, and the place that I see this most often is among the rising number of right-wing people who are openly pagan, you know, and not in any kind of attributive sense. I mean, they say that we are pagans.
Yeah.
Because Japan is apparently a modernized, financially, militarily, but religiously not modernized pagan society, as if you had, you know, ancient Rome, but, you know, they flew airplanes and drove cars. So people are in favor of this, and they think, okay, well, this is great for pulling a people together. And it is. But what I'm saying is that has also been eviscerated. The practice of Shinto is not what it was. The sense of themselves as a people is not what it was. If it were, they would not be slowly going out of existence. The idea that somehow they have modernized, or that they are not also subject to the same historical forces that any people intimately connected to international finance, or the desire to get rich, or having enormous urban areas, just like the rest of us, that somehow that doesn't change any people group in certain determinative and usually deleterious ways is just silly. It's as silly as saying that, you know, the Russian Orthodox Church is doing exactly what the church fathers did in the 5th century. You either accept that you've been subject to history and you deal realistically with that, or you go off into your world and pretend like history didn't happen. And there aren't enormous Japanese banks that worry constantly about what's happening in London in a way that their ancestors never did. Give me a break. Japan is not a counterfactual. It's just an extremely alternative, almost as if it were like alternative history or science fiction, but it actually happened because it was such a different society from, say, England. It is an extreme version of the same fact that affects us all, which is money for modern people, whether they live in Tokyo or London, controls life in a way that it didn't for any of their ancestors 500 years ago.
Money has become a different kind of thing than it was, and that is what modernism ultimately is. A matter of scale The industry is for the sake of scaling the money at the end of the day, and that the point that we've tried to make, I think, over the last four episodes, at least building up, is that this is a factor of fragility in society by its by definition removing ties to the past and pressing the entire society into nothing but a future oriented gain. Spirituality, which ultimately we find to be very uninspirational. It leads to depression and soul loss and things like mass formation psychosis. And closing words?
Yeah. So all of this has been to explain why there are sad Japanese men that just live in their rooms and never open the door.
You're listening to A Brief History of Power. You know where to find us or you wouldn't be here.
Are you wondering where my sermons went? Or where Saturday morning chill went? Well, sorry, it wasn't really clear about this in every avenue. I figured most of you would find me if you wanted to, but if you are looking for those things, they've just diverged into new podcasts. So you'll have to search iTunes or Spotify for Saved. That'll get you the sermons of Pastor Fisk. And Stop the White Noise with Jonathan and Meredith. That's the Saturday morning show. It is available in audio, again, in Spotify or iTunes. Stop the White Noise and Saved. You should check them out.